If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries, plus napkins, plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this, plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, Essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
Hi there. I'm Dave, content director for the History Extra podcast. I hope you don't mind this little interruption. We've welcomed a lot more listeners to our podcast over the past few months, and we're delighted and really grateful to have you on board. Thing is, we'd love it if a few more of you headed over to our website, historyextra.com, to check out some of our content there. We have thousands of features covering a wide variety of historical topics on the site, from ancient Rome, through medieval Europe, and right up to the 20th century. We've just released some exclusive podcasts onto the site too. These are recordings of lectures given at our 2019 History Weekends, and they include talks from Dan Jones on the Crusades, Yanina Ramirez on medieval Wonder Women, Nicola Tallis on Margaret Beaufort, and Peter Caddick Adams on D-Day. Just head over to historyextra.com/exclusive-podcasts to have a listen. I hope you enjoy them, and I hope you carry on listening to this podcast too. Thanks again.
Hello, and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorn. On today's podcast, we've got a conversation with the writer and historian Nicola Cornick. Nicola's new historical novel, The Forgotten Sister, is in part based on the life of Amy Robsart, who was the wife of Robert Dudley, himself a favourite of Queen Elizabeth I. Our deputy digital editor, Eleanor Evans, caught up with Nicola to find out more about Amy's life and mysterious death, and also more broadly about the gaps in history that are ripe for speculation.
So your new novel, The Forgotten Sister, tells the story of Amy Robsart, and many will know her perhaps from her untimely death or her marriage to Robert Dudley, Elizabeth I's favourite. Your book looks a lot more at her life, at the history that's not known. What drew you particularly to her story?
I'm always drawn to the stories of women who I think of them as being in the footnotes of history, if you like. So the thing about Amy for me, well, there were several things I think came together with Amy Robsart's story. The first was that I felt she was constantly eclipsed by Elizabeth and by Robert Dudley, because they're such huge characters, aren't they? And they're very sparkly. And so poor Amy, as you said, she really basically just gets mentioned as a footnote to their story, and the fact that, and obviously because of her mysterious death. And so I started to think, well, you know, who is the real woman behind this story? What were the experiences in her life that actually led up to that point where mostly we only come in at the end? And what had led to that point? So I wanted to research her birth and her background and where she came from, and just have a think about the kind of influences on her as she was growing up, and also her life with Robert before everything kind of got overshadowed by Elizabeth. And also alongside that, I've my sort of special interest as a historian is myths and legends that grow up around particular characters. And so I'm always fascinated by those people who live on. That I think of it as their afterlife. So I really think of this as Amy's afterlife. She's become so much more famous in the afterlife than she was in her time. And that completely fascinates me, because some people, of course, get lost from history altogether, whereas others live on, and of course the stories about them grow and develop. So I was kind of looking at that as well in the book, all the stories about the hauntings and the ghosts of Amy and that kind of thing. So those two things together made her an irresistible character to write about, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wonder if, would you mind introducing us a bit to Amy's life, what you found in your research, you know, before we get to the bigger moments that perhaps she's known for?
Yes, well, first of all, she was born into quite a sort of complicated family, in the sense that she was the youngest. Her father had already had an illegitimate son and then had married a widow who had four children of her own. So there was a sort of quite a complicated family dynamic going on there. She was born in Norfolk, which again, in that period, sort of, she was born in 1532. So although Norwich obviously was a big thriving city, but even so, Norfolk was considered quite a wild and lawless place. And it was so very different from London, and when you read about the court and, of course, Robert Dudley's subsequent career. So I found that very interesting, that kind of early influence. Her father was a very strong Protestant, which again probably was one of the reasons why he and John Dudley, Robert's father, were naturally drawn together as allies, but also would have been a strong influence on Amy's life as well. So I kind of enjoyed, there's very little in the record, so of course I was drawing on things like what sort of upbringing she would have had in a kind of gentleman's household, a modest. Sir John Robsart, her father, was an influential gentleman, but it was nowhere near that rank of nobility that she was soon going to sort of get swept up into. Also, I think about her education as well, because one of the odd enduring myths about Amy is that she was illiterate. I think I blame Sir Walter Scott for that, because when he wrote about Amy in his book Kenilworth, she was this sort of pathetic victim who not only was innocent and maltreated, but also was it totally illiterate as well. Well, we know that isn't true. Of course, we've actually got letters written by her. So all of those things kind of really intrigued me. So it was very interesting to imagine what her life would have been like and what her outlook would have been like coming from that kind of background.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you do a great job of drawing that picture of, you know, a life of a gentleman's daughter. What's known about the when she encountered Dudley? What was known about their marriage initially? You know, how was that met at the time, and how was that perceived more generally?
I think that's interesting, because we've got our own speculation. I mean, again, a lot of it is focused on, was it a love match? And of course, there were comments later, for example, by people like Cecil, saying things like that it was a carnal marriage, and the implication being that they kind of fell madly in love with each other. And I think one of the things that historians have discussed a lot and disagreed over was whether it was actually a love match. What happened? I mean, they may have met as children. We don't know for sure, but there's a possibility that they could have met when Amy certainly spent some time in the household of the Duchess of Norfolk. Whether that coincided with any trips to court and whether she would have met Robert Dudley then, we haven't got any written evidence about that, but it's potentially, it could have been that they met when they were young. Certainly they did meet when Robert went north to put down Kett's rebellion. So they were both 17 at the time, and you can, it's easy to imagine a kind of romantic meeting. He's 17 and eager to go to battle. She's a very pretty girl. We know this because later in comments from ambassadors and various people, they refer to Robert Dudley's very beautiful wife. So you can, it's easy to conjure this sort of idea of them setting eyes on each other again, and it's a sort of a coup de foudre. They're madly in love, and that may be what happened. We do know that certainly Robert and his father and some of his brothers, one of his brothers, I think, did stay at Stansfield at Sir John Robsart's manor when they were going north to put down Kett's rebellion. So that is assumed to be the occasion on which the two of them met again. And from there, it all seems to have happened fairly quickly, which is another argument for that it was a love match, that they were quite keen to marry each other. Because, of course, all of Robert's siblings made very sort of big aristocratic alliances. And so this was a considerably smaller affair, as witnessed by the fact, of course, that when they got married, it was after it was a kind of like a secondary affair the day after his brother got married in a great big celebration. So it was all kind of very much second division marriage, really, because she was only the daughter of a gentleman. So I can imagine at the time people probably thought, well, he could have done better for himself, which again gives some sort of support to the idea that it was what Robert wanted at the time and that they were pretty keen on each other, I think.
Mm-hmm. And also, is it fair to say that, you know, he comes across it in your account in other sources as this fairly ambitious individual? So if we move to his relationship with Elizabeth, you know, where does that sit in his life? How did he pursue that? What's known about that?
Yes, I think one of the impressions I had about Robert when I was reading about him, I mean, he doesn't come over particularly well in the book, I think it's fair to say. And he was, even in the early stages, well, when he and Amy were first married, and actually sort of kind of going back a step there, it was a way, marrying her was a way to establish himself in that particular part of the world that fitted his father's ambitions to have a stronger presence as a counterbalance to the Duke of Norfolk in East Anglia. So it wasn't all one-sided. It wasn't just Amy kind of making a really dazzling match. There were material benefits to Robert to increasing his estates and his influence in Norfolk. And I think that fits really well with what you've said about his character, because absolutely, you see it all the way through. So, for example, after the failure of the plot to put Jane Grey on the throne when he was in the Tower of London, he somehow extraordinarily manages to come back from that before we're even on to Elizabeth's time. He comes back from that in order by joining the retinue of Philip of Spain, Mary's husband. Now, that seems a very unlikely kind of involvement, and yet somehow he manages to become popular, one of Philip's, because I guess, you know, he was a young man, he was his prowess and jousting and all the other things. He was part of that sort of peacocking court, the masculine side of things there. And I find that extraordinary, that from being the person sent to actually try and apprehend Mary Tudor in order to prevent her from gaining the throne, there's this kind of turnaround where, whilst obviously he was in no way in favour with her, he was certainly part of Philip's retinue. So even before he spies the main chance with Elizabeth, I think, you know, he's kind of in there still working his way up. And then, of course, it becomes apparent that Mary's unlikely to have a child and that her her health is poor. And I think all the way along, he had a particular connection with Elizabeth even before that. But it's from that point where we see Mary in decline, I think, that you realise, you see Robert realising, OK, you know, I've got a really massive opportunity here now with Elizabeth. It's all going to come right. And from then on, his focus just seems to be entirely on her, and poor old Amy gets sent off to the country. And that's the end of that for her, really.
Mm-hmm. I know it is. I mean, I know you just said you don't necessarily want to have the whole picture of her being mistreated and, you know, a complete cipher for this sadness. But obviously she was very, you know, hard done by. And what kind of evidence is there for how much she knew about Robert and Elizabeth's relationship? You know, how much did she know? How much did she feel that humiliation, or, you know, what was her feeling?
There's very little expression of that from her directly, because we don't have letters from her expressing you know, her sorrow. We can infer from the fact that there was general gossip about Robert and Elizabeth that would have reached her ears, I think, and also from comments made by her servants, for example, after she died, that there were times when she was very sad and had actually prayed to be released from this sort of misery. So I think, as with a lot of these things where the evidence is very sparse, it's kind of speculation, but I think it's strongly suggested that she was aware of his relationship with Elizabeth, the fact that he spent all his time at court, and they barely saw each other towards the end of her life. You know, they had one or two meetings, and really it kind of felt as though she had just been tidied away, if you like, in first to Throcking, where she was put up at, you know, in a manor house belonging to one of Robert's friends, and then shifted, a bit like a piece of unwanted luggage is the feeling that you get. She's moved from there over to Cumnor, out of the way, and to these incredibly tiny sort of places, hamlets, where there's no society. I mean, obviously Cumnor was not that far from Abingdon and Oxford, but even so, and Throcking, you know, a village of 8 people, it contrasted with the kind of exciting life he's having at court, it feels very, very unkind. So yes, it's hard, because I suppose we're also putting our own feelings into that, that, you know, if you get shunted off somewhere and left on your own, you are basically going to be very unhappy. And then if you hear rumours about your husband and some other woman who happens to be the Queen, even more so. So, yes, I think we can't get away from the fact that that part of her life must have been very sad, I think.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
So I think what I was trying to do with my research into the book and also with the story itself was just to say, you know, Amy deserves to be more than just a woman in the footnotes. And it's interesting to find out more about her as that historical character, rather than somebody who's just swept up in the bigger narrative of Robert and Elizabeth.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it, so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries, plus napkins, plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this, plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
You mentioned Cumnor there, and I wonder if before we perhaps go to, you know, that's obviously the site of her death, before we talk about that event, can we talk about the halls that you feature in your book? Because a lot of your books are set or inspired by these Gothic halls or manors around. What was Cumnor like?
Well, Cumnor, of course, isn't there anymore. Yeah. And actually, in a funny kind of way, that its presence is still very strong. One of the things I have done in my books, oddly, is write about various places that aren't there anymore, or places that are there that have fallen into disrepair. Because that really fascinates me, the idea of previous glories and how that's gone. And of course, the thing about Cumnor that is particularly interesting, and I do bring into the book from my perspective, was the way it was reused. I absolutely love this idea that at the beginning of the 19th century, the Earl of Abingdon moved reused the stone from Cumnor, which had fallen into disrepair by the middle of the 18th century, to build a new house over at Witham near Oxford and to rebuild the church. So this idea of transferring part of the actual fabric of the building, as well as the memories associated with that, went somewhere else. And so I do particularly enjoy this idea that there are feelings and memories associated very strongly with particular buildings. And that sometimes you can sort of tap into that if you go to the site, as you say, you go somewhere like Cumnor, you stand by the church where the manor house was, and you can kind of just absorb the sense of the atmosphere of it and the sense of what it would have been like in the 16th century.
Mm-hmm. And it is at this site that Amy dies. Perhaps we can go into the events and what's known, sort of specifically known, and then perhaps what avenues are open for speculation without giving away too much of what you do in your book.
Okay. Yes. Well, all that is definitely known is that on the 8th of September 1560, Amy fell down a flight of stairs and was found with a broken neck at the bottom of the stairs. And as soon as word got to Robert that this had happened, he sent one of his men, Thomas Blount, to interview the servants and the staff to find out what had happened. So we have a record of what they have said the events were running up to this from his interviews afterwards. So, for example, we're told Amy had been in a strange mood that day. It was actually a Sunday, but she had encouraged all of the members of the household to go to the fair in Abingdon, as though she wanted to be alone. She was in a bad mood, some of her servants said. And when two of the ladies of the household refused to go, saying it wasn't appropriate on a Sunday for gentlewomen to go to the fair, she got very cross and said, "Oh, well, you know, fair enough if you want to stay here, but kind of leave me alone." So there was from the start this suggestion that she'd been in a sad mood, a sort of a despairing mood that day, which is where the idea came from that she might have thrown herself down the stairs. But of course, a mysterious death like that was immediately seized upon as suspicious by those people who wanted to use it against Robert Dudley. And I think it was he immediately cottoned on to the fact that this was actually very bad news for him. One of the things that I actually don't like about Robert was that, as far as I'm aware, he didn't once express any sorrow for the fact that she had died. He just said, "I hear my wife's fallen down," obviously I'm paraphrasing, "I hear my wife's fallen down the stairs. What's going on? And can you make sure that none of this reflects badly on me?" And so, of course, you know, your sympathies are not really with him, even if he didn't know anything about it or wasn't involved in any kind of foul play. It doesn't come over terribly well. So, yes, immediately there were these two theories, competing theories, that either she'd killed herself because he had been so cruel to her, or possibly that he had arranged for somebody to push her down the stairs so that he could marry Elizabeth, because they had been so close and there was a lot of speculation about it. And added into all of this gossip and scandal that had been going around was the fact that there were rumours that Amy had been ill. So, you know, was it a natural death? But also suggestions that Elizabeth herself had known that, or said aloud, that Amy was about to die. How did she know this? So all of this huge morass of gossip and rumour all came together, and Robert was trying to sort of fight his way through this to find out, well, one conjectures what really happened, assuming that he didn't already know. So, yes, we've got these kind of competing narratives of what happened in the run-up to Amy's death and what had caused it.
And your novel then explores, with this effective split timeline narrative, you know, there's a window there for speculation. There's historical gaps that, you know, can be filled by fiction. So what can you say about that process?
Yes, well, I always think, as somebody who's studied history, and public history, there's always a kind of a slight discordance in my head, a dissonance between facts and fictions. It's quite hard when you're a historian who's also a fiction writer. But I have learned as I've gone along that actually sometimes the gaps between fact and fiction are maybe narrower than you think, because obviously any historian is writing a narrative, they put a perspective on it. So as you say, absolutely, as a historical novelist, the gaps in the record leave you that space to sort of speculate what's happened. I mean, I have to say that my solution in the book is entirely fictional. I hope I make that clear. But yes, I mean, I think that there is that sort of that's one of the interesting things about Amy's story. I think you could speculate on any one of those solutions to the mystery and make a good case for any of them in a fictional narrative.
Mm-hmm. So going back to the aftermath then, obviously it's a very tragic thing. A young woman loses her life, you know, and it obviously has an impact on Dudley's prospects. What's known about how the Queen reacted? What was her initial reaction to it?
Yes, well, I think she also, like Robert Dudley, saw how incredibly dangerous this was for her, because she just simply could not be tainted by that particular scandal. I mean, it was a gift really to all those who wanted to, and there were plenty of people who wanted to see Dudley's influence reduced, if you like. I think superficially, she distanced herself from him. She sent him away. The court wore black, which felt like it feels a little hypocritical. But they kind of they did observe the niceties. I think underneath that, there was no likelihood at all of Elizabeth wanting to distance herself from the emotional support she was getting from Robert Dudley. She just didn't want it to be too blatant at that time. And of course, the other thing is, who knows whether Elizabeth ever really entertained the idea of marrying Dudley, or indeed anybody else. But I think it most definitely put that out of all possible reckoning. I mean, I'm inclined to think that she never intended to marry him or indeed anyone anyway. But I think she kind of wanted her cake and eating it, really. She wanted him around and all the benefits of his company. She really did. She loved him. I mean, I think she really did love him as a friend and as somebody who understood her and they were very close. But of course, she just couldn't be seen to be tainted with that particular scandal. So, yeah, that was the end of his hopes. But I can't be sorry for that, really.
No, not too much. You mentioned Scott already, and I was wondering if we could chat a bit about how Amy was then represented after her death. You know, what are the sources there that tell us how she was viewed, how her death was viewed?
Yes, it's her story starts to grow. In two different ways, I think. I mean, first of all, there's those people who want to continue to use this story against Robert Dudley, and they know it's always going to be a stick to beat him with. Every time it seems he's particularly influential, they can drag it out again and remember, you know, he killed his wife kind of thing. So, of course, there's Leicester's Commonwealth, which is the first written by his enemies, which is sort of the first... I think the first written piece that comes out directly in writing accusing him of murdering his wife. And that acts as a sort of inspiration for fictional writers. And already by the 17th century, there are plays in which it's early 17th century, I think 1610 might be, 1608, 1610, with the first reference to an anonymous, they refer to him as a politician, killing his wife. And then, of course, there's The White Devil, which also draws on that a similar kind of idea. So all these rumours were present through the 17th and into the 18th century. But I think we do owe an awful lot to Walter Scott, if you want to look at it that way, in terms of turning Amy and the story into this idea of the innocent, tragic heroine who's so badly mistreated, because, of course, it is Scott's book, Kenilworth, which came out in 1821, that also chimed so beautifully with the whole, both the romantic kind of idea of the romanticism of the wildness that he draws in all. I mean, for a start, he conflates lots of different people into Amy, but he also sort of draws on the wildness of the countryside, and he makes a great rollicking story of it all. In fact, as an interesting sideline, I actually discovered when I was researching it that Sir Walter Scott came to stay in my village where I live when he was researching Wayland Smithy, which features in Kenilworth. As part of Amy's story. I had absolutely no idea about that. So that was an astonishing discovery. But so he throws in all the galloping through the wild Oxfordshire countryside, and he really makes a big romantic tale of it. And of course, there's also the Gothic element, the horrible death, the evil assailants who work for Robert. So he makes this great yarn of it, and of course it takes off after that. The whole story just flies. There are operas inspired by it. There are plays. There are other stories, and that brings it into the public consciousness in the Victorian period. And it's interesting also that that's the point that all the ghost stories about Amy take off as well. So you don't hear about Amy's, I mean, you hear it backdated, but you don't hear records of Amy's ghost apparently being seen before the 19th century. And I think that's kind of very telling, that it caught the public imagination.
So how would you, I guess, you know, perhaps with your historian's hat on and with your historical novelist hat on, how would you like to see Amy's story, you know, being maybe reappraised, or, you know, how would you like people to think of her beyond what's already, you know, there in the popular consciousness?
I think we can't get away from Amy's end, but and the sadness of her death, and probably the fact that mystery will never be particularly solved. But I would very much, I hope I've put more emphasis on what happened before that, more emphasis on Amy as a person in her own right. So I think what I was trying to do with my research into the book and also with the story itself was just to say, you know, Amy deserves to be more than just a woman in the footnotes. She deserves to be looked at, you know, her life deserves to be researched. She was a person in her own right. And it's interesting to find out more about her as that historical character rather than somebody who's just swept up in the bigger narrative of Robert and Elizabeth. So I hope that that's what I've done in the book, and I hope that it will, you know, generate more interest in Amy herself, because I think she did have, in her short life, a very interesting story.
That was Nicola Cornick. Her novel, The Forgotten Sister, is published by HQ and is out now. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Tune in tomorrow for another lecture on medieval life.